Brian Had a Dream, 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000. Hey, I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
Welcome once again to the quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. In this episode, school is back in session almost, and we are coming up also on Brian's birthday. So what better time to reflect on lessons that Brian has learned so far as he moves closer and closer to 10,000 movies. Our top five will be part of that theme as well, as Brian shares his top five teachers in film. But before we get all to that, remember you can join this conversation on Twitter at 10K Movies, T-E-N-K Movies, on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. Brian, where are you on the quest?
8,121.
And by your birthday in about a week, where do you think you'll be?
I'll fall just short of 8,150. I'll be about 8,140, 8,130, 38, something like that. That's my anticipation. I'd like to get to 8,150. Don't think I will, but I'll be close.
All right, so that'll give you about 2 years and about 1,800 movies to go, a little less than 900 movies a year. That seems like a pretty reasonable pace for you.
Yeah, it does. That's what I've been kind of doing the mental math in my head. I have sort of, you know, checkpoints, and birthdays are obviously big ones. I feel like I'm on pace.
Well, that's good. Well, what is the last movie that you saw that you want to share with us now?
I love the little qualifier about movie that I want to share. Some movies I don't really want to talk about.
You don't want to admit to anyone, not even yourself, that you've seen.
Well, the last movie I saw was a silent film from the 1910s called The Land Beyond the Sunset. Watched it because it's in the National Film Registry. And it's a depressing little film about a boy who is in a home where his grandmother is mean to him. Not really abusive, just mean, just takes his money. And he wins a trip to go into a day out at a camp. And then when all the other kids, and they tell a fairy tale about this kid that escaped this evil troll and went off into the sunset. So when the other kids leave the camp to go back home, he sort of staggers behind and hides. He sees a rowboat against the lake, and he just paddles out into the lake. End of story. Like, very depressing, very dark. Very.
Oh, I get it. He's the kid going into the sun, escaping the troll.
Yeah, so that is very.
I love also how you say she's not really abusive to him. She just takes his money.
Yeah. Well, she does. She wasn't physically abusive. She wasn't even, I know, really verbally abusive. It's just he came in and he got some money and she said, "Give me that." And that was it.
Of course. Well, of course, not verbally. It was a silent movie. So.
It was a silent movie.
So, moving on, tell us a movie that you would recommend us perhaps to see.
I didn't say I wouldn't recommend that. I wouldn't, though. But watch The Getaway, a movie with Steve McQueen, Ally McGraw from the 1970s. And then they fell in love during the course of the movie, and she divorced her husband, married him. And it was a good vintage 70s movie. I mean, if you like Steve McQueen at all, you like that kind of vibe, you would have liked this movie.
Now, you say vintage 70s movie, and I think that's a great segue into our topic at hand for this episode. The lessons you have learned so far on your journey to watch these 10,000 movies. So I want to start there with what have you learned about the different eras, maybe, of movies? What makes something a vintage 70s movie to be different than movies made in another decade?
The 70s were hot, were like, the color palette was a little more muted than it would have been. The 50s would have been really bright technicolor and really popping colors and really deep, dark reds and really, you know, the 70s feel more pastel, but the 70s have a more of a grit and a grime to them. It's like they want it. They don't want it to look like it was filmed on a back lot. You know, they're trying to go the opposite direction of that. And then so that's what makes a vintage 70s movie to me, is it's got to be sort of grimy in a way, but not in necessarily a dirty way, but just it doesn't look picture perfect.
Right. And would you say that those changes in aesthetics, that's been something that you've come to be more and more aware of as you've watched all these different 8,100 plus movies?
Well, yeah, because what you can see is you can see how they build. And there's a couple of movies about that process, about that build. I think his name's Mark Cousins. He did an 11-part documentary called Film and Odyssey. And he kind of works you through and goes through and talks about how this builds to this and this leads to that and this leads to that. So, yeah, you can see it. You can see sort of the lineage.
So what would you say are the other some of the other lessons that you have learned as you've gone through this process? Maybe it's about film itself. Maybe it's about yourself. Maybe it's about other people's patience and time with you. What would you say? What have been some of the highlights, the things you feel like you've learned through?
Well, one thing, you watch a lot of movies and you get a feel for how most, not just people, but most critics, you tend to like, the last thing you saw is always the best thing you saw. And it's hard to pull yourself back and not go with that. You know what I'm saying? Not be overwhelmed by the last great thing you saw was the absolute best of all time. Perspective is a really hard thing to come by. And it, you know, it takes patience and it takes, and it's so, you know, we live in a world of hot takes, obviously, and everybody wants to immediately say, pronounce, you know, how they figure something out. But we very rarely are we willing to look back and see and try to get a sense for the big picture. And I think that's true in movies too.
What about yourself? Do you feel like you've learned?
Well, one thing I think is that you see how you watch a lot of movies and you see how universal some things are that maybe you don't understand. You see that, you know, the problems people are dealing with in Japan or in India or in whatever, that they are relatable in a way maybe you don't realize. But you also, if you watch enough films, you get a sense of different groups in a way that maybe you wouldn't have exposed yourself to otherwise. And I'm talking about disenfranchised groups, whether they be homosexuals or you know, you watch films of black films by black filmmakers, and you suddenly you have a new appreciation for some things that maybe you wouldn't have. Now, I know that they are trying to manipulate you to see their point of view, and you take all that with a grain of salt, but you still see it, you know, and you hear it in a way that maybe you wouldn't have seen it if you didn't expose yourself to.
So again, that's a lesson in perspective.
I will say a lot of my political, not just political, but a lot of my assumptions and feelings about certain, you know, groups or things, whatever, have changed over the past 3 or 4 years as I've watched more movies because I'm more sympathetic. You do find yourself to be more empathetic to the plight of others because you see their points of view more. You get invested in different things that you wouldn't have been otherwise.
Well, that's very positive, it sounds like. What have you learned, though, about your own individual taste in film as you go? And one of the reference points here, I think we've talked about before, how before you started this, you really weren't a huge fan of certain types of movies, genre of movies, being one of them. So what have you learned that's reinforced that kind of awareness of what you like and don't like, and what maybe have you learned, like, oh no, wait, I really do kind of
I will say this, it is, and I have a greater appreciation for the people that can make a comedy that stands the test of time, because you think back and you think, oh, my favorite movies were, you know, you want to say they're these movies that made you laugh, but then you watch it again and you don't laugh. Comedies don't hold up as well, just because they're in the moment, and once you've seen it, sort of that it's gone, like they're very ephemeral. You know, it's very much like you've got to watch it now, and then it dissipates and it's gone. So I find that I'm much more moved, or much more likely to really gravitate towards a movie that makes me feel something than I am a movie that makes me laugh.
Tell us about something maybe that you watched and found out, hey, I really do kind of enjoy this. Or maybe it's a filmmaker or actor, actress that you've enjoyed in that realm. And yeah, then maybe another lesson you've learned is like, nope, this just reinforces previous thoughts that I had.
Well, one person that I was familiar with but not in love with beforehand now. Really do appreciate it. I love Buster Keaton. I think his stuff is fantastic. And I think, you know, whereas Chaplin zigged, Keaton zagged, and unfortunately, Chaplin's business sense was better. So I really have enjoyed like watching some of the old silent films from him. And he transitioned into talkies, but not as effectively. You know, I've watched a lot more horror movies than I would have thought, and they're still mostly cheesy. But when they're done well, I mean, a movie from movie Jordan Peele did earlier this year. They can be good, and I see how horror has a place, a way to kind of like get into things. But for the most part, you know, they're pretty formulaic. I find that I like art house films more than I thought I would. Some avant-garde stuff more than I thought I would. Like there's a French director from he's from the 30s into the 60s, Jean Cocteau, who I really like. He has a trilogy that I really like, you know, and I wouldn't have watched it otherwise. I mean, I would have never known about it.
See, I thought you were going to go into, and this is sort of me trying to subtly hint on another rant for the what I'll call the God is not dead genre.
Oh my gosh.
The film you watch, you're like, I know I'm going to hate this. And yes, indeed. I hate this.
I will say, I like spiritual themed films. Films that try to challenge. Sure. I don't like spiritual propaganda films. I just don't. Even if I'm sympathetic to what they're trying to say, it just sketches me out because it's just so bad. And I see that everyone else that's watching it, that you're supposedly, it's, to me, it's it, in a way, and I'm not trying to be flippant or ugly, but it's spiritual masturbation. It's for you. Like you're not, you say you're doing, no one is going to do this and come to you. You're doing this so that you can feel better about yourself. And that's the opposite of what you should be doing. But
you alluded this to before a little bit, but and you said you become more sympathetic, empathetic, that sort of thing through film. I wonder about how you've applied those lessons though, kind of outside of your movie watching. Is that something you feel like you are continuing to kind of wrestle with and apply in some way? Or
Well, I will say this. Okay, I'm more, just because I am more empathetic, and I do think that I understand and try to see other points of view that maybe I didn't before. But it's difficult to really put it into action. So you're right; it is a struggle to find out where do you plug that in. Where do you, you know, how can you alleviate some of this problem you now see you didn't see before? I continue to struggle with ways in which to do that. But at least I feel like now I'm aware of it in a way I wasn't 3 or 4 years ago, which is, you know, a big step, a huge step for a lot of people. It's just being aware and not having those preconceived sort of walls that you built up to where, you know, it's the same thing. Like my friend Randy, who loves movies. He had this hang up about watching a foreign language film. Like he wouldn't, and he didn't. And, you know, he's in his 30s, and he's just, you know, and once he did, you know, it opened up this world because it wasn't as inaccessible as he thought it was. So, you know, that's what you do to yourself.
So last question on this subject, we began kind of with a brief just mention of different aesthetics and different periods of film, that maybe being one of the things that you first sort of noticed as you look through all these movies. So I want to ask, do you think there are certain lessons in a given decade that they're trying to push more and more? Like you said, the 70s, sort of this gritty realism, that was kind of the lesson of like, look at the world around you and, you know, kind of that sort of thing. What would be maybe other similar lessons from, let's just say, the last 10 years of a film? Could you boil it down to maybe a couple of themes or ideas that movies seem to want to be teaching people right now?
Well, you know, after, especially American films, and in lesser degree of films outside of America, you know, there was this big, after September 11th, I think there was a big emphasis on interaction of culture. Where do cultures, you know, where do they collide? Where do they diverge? Where's the common ground? I think you see that a lot. And also this idea of security. I think a lot of films are, whether they're explicit or not, it's about, where do you find that secure? Where can you be safe? Can you be safe? And then also, in the past, since, in the past 4 or 5 years, I think there's been a huge just push in movies to represent non-traditional gender ideas. A huge, huge push in it, and not so much, going back, in the 90s and in the 80s, I think there was a push maybe towards racial dynamics. But we've moved beyond, the films at least have sort of moved beyond that, and I think it's trying to push people into new directions as far as, how you relate to each people that have different conceptions of what gender is. How do you coexist with those people? How did each group coexist?
Lessons and ideas and thoughts that are still being
And
unpacked
movies,
and explored.
in so many ways, movies are both a product of the culture and driving the culture. So if it's a cultural issue, it's going to be represented somewhere.
Right. I said the last question was the last question, but I thought of another one while you were talking. My thought is, you began this project as just someone, oh, hey, I like movies. I love movies. I'm a fan.
Well, I started just trying to see if I could watch a movie a day every day.
Right. I mean, it was kind of a challenge. It was a fun thing to do. It was something that was, I don't want to say it was a lark or a second thought, but it's grown into something a little bit more than what it started, I think it's fair to say. And probably started out more just a fan of films. Would you consider yourself now, have you become more a student of film in some odd way since you started? You can still consider mainly you're more of a fan rather than kind of a
I would
student.
still say more of a fan, because see, the thing I like most about films is the story. And that's really what I gravitate towards too, is when I watch a good film, if I learn anything, or the thing that I'm a student of is how do you tell a good story? I'm not really fluent in where the camera should be or what angle it should be, or should these colors be muted. I mean, I can appreciate it and I see some of it, and some of it I certainly recognize and I'm blown away by just like anybody else. But I don't necessarily know like when you should, how do you control whatever. What I'm interested in is how do you tell a story? And that I do think I have a better idea of in a lot of ways than I did when I started.
So it sounds like if film has taught you anything, it's about the importance that characters and motivations and things like that play. And that's a great way to get into, I think, our top five now, which may be a little more controversial and polarizing than normal between us. Usually I can see where you're coming on your top five, or there's someone in your top five. I have no clue who that is or what that movie is. And so I'm just like, sure, whatever. This one, I think I have some strong opinions on, but it is your top five.
We talked about
Top
it
five
briefly. Well,
teachers in film. Now, do we need to give any caveats here? Because teacher could be a broad category.
sure. We talked about this before we did, and I want it to be teacher, not necessarily mentor. Because mentor is a different sort of relationship, and then you get into father figure ideas. This needs to be somebody who's teaching a formal way.
So this
Okay,
is
I'm
a classroom context. I can
not
agree with
necessarily
that.
classroom, but needs to be,
A traditional sort of framework of teachers, yes,
for
for
me,
sure.
and that's
And
what I
so, and I'll
use.
say I agree with this, but I think there's one person who's not on your list, and we'll talk about that at the end.
Well,
So.
I made room for the okay. First off, I got a couple of honorable mentions that I want to throw out there that didn't quite make the list that I love care. Okay, in Whiplash, J.K. Simmons' character, I don't know the character's name, but he's a hard ass, he's horrible, but he does impart some real lessons. And of course, he's a rude guy, but I love that performance and love that film. Another one we talked about that I didn't necessarily think of right here, still not making my top five, School of Rock. Yes, he taught them, but what did he really teach them? To okay to lie, and okay, so but good character. So moving on then to the actual top five. Number five is a film from the 70s about the realities of law school and how punishing it can be. And it's John Houseman won an Oscar for his work, and it's called The Paper Chase. And it's a movie I vaguely remember when I was a kid. There was like a TV series based on the movie that came out in the early 80s, and I watched. So that's part of why I like it. But, number four, this is, in a way, I'm throwing a bone here. I'm going to go ahead and say Mr. Miyagi is number four.
Okay. This is the one that I didn't think was going to make your top five.
Yeah.
It is someone who gets maybe more influential with father figure roles, but he's a teacher. Danielson is his student.
He's not a teacher, though. I mean, he is a janitor.
He teaches him how to do all this, like, work with his hands.
He is a maintenance man.
Also karate. And
Maintenance man who suffered horribly in World War II.
And a really creepy, weird scene. Yes, I get that. But he teaches Daniel's son karate. And Daniel's son doesn't even know it. It's amazing. It's just,
I mean, he teaches him patience, I guess, but...
How to catch a fly with chopsticks.
I put it in the list because the montage where he's doing the wax on, wax off, he's doing all that, that has been hugely influential. And when mostly now it's become derivative and parodied. But when you want to show that somebody you use callbacks to that sort of sequence. So I'll give you that's a pretty important part.
Life lessons. That's what he imparted, Mr. Miyagi. Well, I'm glad you came to your senses to put him in your top five. So that's good. He's number three.
Number three, if you think teachers in film, especially people our age, you cannot help. You have to deal with this character, and this is John Keating from Dead Poets Society. Yeah. Now the question becomes, was he a good teacher or not? I say no, because he drove one of his kids to suicide. He contributed to the climate that encouraged that kid to kill himself.
I would say his father, played by the esteemed...
His father, of course, was an asshole. I mean, I'm giving you that.
And the headmaster and probably...
The headmaster had very little to do with it. I think
his own sense of just being depressed probably did that as much as John Keating did. But, for me, the thing, the quintessential sort of teacher scene in that, isn't the carpe diem, isn't the standing on top
of
the thing. Actually, to me, it's the scene with Ethan Hawke when he didn't prepare anything. And that scene where, he's just...
Sweaty Tooth Madman?
Yeah, the Sweaty Tooth
Madman. Talk about the Sweaty Tooth Madman? I love that scene!
Yeah, that's the best scene
you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm going to go into this and say, and no one can argue with you. Because when I think of that movie, I do think of him looking at that picture of Walt Whitman and just coming up and saying, and when I see a picture of Walt Whitman, the first thing I think of is how sweaty his teeth are.
Sweaty teeth. Yeah.
I mean, that is a fantastic.
Yeah. Mr. Pitt, rise above your name, and Mr. Meek.
I will say that I think that, again, with the caveat that special people are able, but I think people that are teaching now that are in their 35 to 40-year-old range, they are teaching in large part because they want to be Mr. Keating. I mean, I think that's...
Which is probably a whole other problem in and of itself. But moving on to number two, the way in which we would
handle kids and situations has changed dramatically since the way that. But anyhow, that's not the point. Okay, number two. Trying to pick one from this, probably the most iconic series set in a high school sort of environment. That's the Harry Potter series. And it's not, I know it's not necessarily, but it's a high school environment for the most part. And trying to pick, I told myself I just had to pick one. Which one? Because, you could list a dozen different teachers in various capacities. But really the best teacher was Snape. Snape was the best teacher at the school.
Okay. Explain more. Say more. Because I would have gone probably with Lupin.
I like
can't
Lily.
go with McGonagall from the movies because she just wasn't in enough teaching.
No, she's so non-existent.
But
like, she's there for Maggie Smith to get a credit. Like, it's like she shows up every now and then, but she's not very active. She doesn't do a lot. I mean, at Dumbledore, we didn't see him teach. You know, we only saw him teach Tom Riddle, and that's it. And that didn't end. And I guess he also taught Hagrid. But you know, at the end, you know, and I don't know. I just Snape. If you look at which one of the characters, which one of the teachers had the biggest impact on Harry's life, I think Snape would be the answer.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true. Of course, it lets us give a shout out to the late great Alan Rickman, who a role an actor just very well met.
Originally, apparently, when they were first casting for Harry Potter, their first choice and the person had to turn it down, Timothy Roth. Had to turn it down because he had a prior commitment, or he chose to be in Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes remake instead. So, not so wise a decision, but also a fortuitous happenstance, because I can't imagine he would have been as good as an iconic as Alan was.
That's right. Well, speaking of iconic, I think I do know who your number one is going to be.
Yeah, and this is partially in part because of where we're from. I think, you know, that helps. But it was a great performance in the movie. I'm looking at The Miracle Worker with Anne Bancroft as Annie Sullivan. You know, and you want to talk about a challenging teaching environment and all of the checklist of what you want in a great teacher, you know, patience, perseverance, you know, creativity, all those things, you know, they're all checked off in that movie, and she perseveres, and she, you know, she brought somebody that otherwise would have been relegated to nothing and gave them everything. And that's the best you can hope for teacher can do.
I totally agree with that as number one. A couple other also-rans, you mentioned honorable mentions. You know, some people immediately jump to teachers of a Jedi persuasion, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Yoda.
I just don't see them as teachers. I mean,
Obi-Wan, like, taught Luke what a lightsaber was and lied to him.
Are they teachers or trainers?
They're great characters, not great teachers. A couple others that just bear worth mentioning. Richard Dreyfuss as Mr. Holland. Mr. Holland's
in that movie.
Probably would have been my
I think you got to talk about Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds, because you know, that movie sort of become an iconic go-to.
Yeah, and another one I thought of, I think, when you said Paper Chase, a legal law professor, Mark Landau in Rounders, a teacher who gives literally everything he has for his students so he won't get killed by gangsters. Pretty impressive teaching sacrifice there too. But
I'm sure I may have missed. I mean, we probably glossed over one or two that we would have.
Tell us who we glossed over by dropping us a line again on Twitter at 10K Movies or going to Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. Thank you so much for listening and downloading this episode. Hope that you might also share it with your friend as we move ever closer to 10,000 movies and two more years until Brian turns 40. Until we come back with our episode in 2 weeks, though we hope your week now will be a 10.
A 10 plus? Borderline.
Happy birthday, Brian.